Welcome to Season 6 of the Common Ground Unity Podcast. Jesus valued unity and prayed for it. We believe unity begins with Jesus-centered relationships, gathering around a table, sharing a cup of coffee or a meal. We like to say unity begins with a cup of coffee. So grab a cup and let's get started with another episode.
I offer what sounds like really simplistic advice at the very beginning of the book, but it's say, ouch, say it hurts. I think that's what I needed to do at 42 years old as someone who's a therapist, as someone who is guiding people into these kinds of conversations. Mm-hmm. I had to say, you know, I'm hurting in a way that I don't think I've acknowledged, and it's costing me, it's costing my family, it's impacting my vocation and so much more.
Welcome, everyone, to Common Grounds Unity Podcast. We are on episode 183. It's hard to believe that we have so much content, and I invite you to look back through those guests that we've had, and especially as we have some extra time between Christmas and New Year's to really dig into some interesting and life-giving conversations. And today we have a guest that has been with us before. And so I'll be mentioning that a little later so that you can go back and check that out. I'm Tina Bruner, and I'm so happy to co-host today with David Bruce. He is a licensed marriage and family therapist, an addiction counselor, and serves as an elder at Turning Point Church in Los Angeles. He's married to his best friend, Cece, and they have two children. To learn more about David, please listen to episodes 171 and 172 on emotionally healthy spirituality. And we would like to welcome you, David, to this side of the microphone. How are things today out in Los Angeles?
Well, thank you, Tina, so much for having me. And things are warm and bright in December in LA, getting spoiled when you think about how people are doing in other parts of the country. But so grateful to be back here. Love this podcast.
Yeah, well, and Chuck is in Michigan, so I'm sure he's got a much different perspective than yours from Los Angeles.
That's correct. That's correct. Yeah. We are excited to have Chuck DeGroat back on our podcast. Chuck is a licensed professional counselor, professor at Western Theological Seminary in Holland, Michigan, a faculty member at the Soul Care Institute, a spiritual director, and the author of 6 books, including When Narcissism Comes to Church, Healing Your Community from Emotional and Spiritual Abuse. Chuck and his wife, Sarah, live in Michigan and have 2 daughters. To learn more about Chuck, please listen to episode 120. Welcome back, Chuck.
Thanks. So good to be with you guys again. Thanks for having me on a chilly day in Michigan.
Excellent. Well, we're excited about this episode, but Chuck, why don't you just share a little bit about what's going on in life right now for you?
Yeah, well, I'm at the tail end of a sabbatical. I was a pastor for a long time, and of course, I've been a therapist for a long time, but I've been teaching for the last 13 years, and we get sabbaticals every now and then, and so I've been doing some writing. I'm done with another manuscript that's in the editing phase and getting prepared to be back in the classroom again. We started a clinical mental health counseling program here at the seminary, and so I'm stewarding that work right now too. And so I'm eager to get back in with our clinical mental health counseling students and our Master of Divinity students and get back in the classroom.
That sounds great. You know, I do a lot of work overseas with different countries and cultures who are pretty far behind in the training of mental health professionals. So it's so exciting to hear about the work that you're doing and the things that you're publishing, because it's a lot easier to get those translated as a bridge between when Christian-based or even secular-based mental health programs are available. There's a lot of resources that I point people to, and your work is are some of those resources. So I'm really grateful for your work. Last time you were on the podcast, we talked about two of your books, Wholeheartedness and When the Narcissist Comes to Church, which is my favorite title of a book ever. When I share that with friends, they're like, what? I'm like, oh, you've got to just read this book. It's like that whole idea of narcissists not being in our churches is not being able to name something that's real in the church. It has become such a barrier to identifying and changing that. So I'm so grateful for that work. And today we're talking about your sixth book, which is Healing What's Within, Coming Home to Yourself and to God When You're Wounded, Weary, and Wandering. And I think that is such a poignant and timely gift to us in the church. So can you give us a big picture of this book and speak to this idea of coming home to yourself?
Yeah. Well, you know, in some ways, this book did come out of that previous work, because I, you know, for really over 25 years now, I've been in the arena of spiritual abuse. And my story, it's a lot of people's stories, that we have these things that happen to us and we're not really sure what to do with them, right? And this book is really the shift from what happened to you to what happens within you. When we talk about trauma, we're talking about what happens within you, how, what's the wound that is left behind from what happened to you, right? So in one sense, when narcissism comes to church, is diagnostic. Here's what happens in the church. Here's what happens with particular kinds of ministry leaders, nonprofit leaders, pastors. But now let's talk about the wound that is left behind. And when we talk about trauma, we've got to talk in one sense about disconnection, how we become disconnected from ourselves, how we become disconnected from one another to survive. And so that's in part why the subtitle is Coming Home to Yourself, to God, and to each other, however it goes, when you're wounded, weary, and wandering, because the reality is we become disconnected, fragmented, divided within. That goes back to some of the themes of wholeheartedness, actually.
So, Chuck, you share stories about those who have experienced tragedy or trauma and have sanitized their pain. This seems very common in our Western culture and in our Christian faith, and even among Christian leaders. Can you speak to how your inability to process trauma in healthy ways and to lament harms our culture, faith, and leadership?
So you want me to speak to my own pain a little bit here, huh? I think that I couldn't get away with writing this book without telling a bit of my own story. And that was encouraged a bit by my editor as well. Every time I wanted to back out, she's like, come on, lean in just a little bit more. But the reality is that even though I was a licensed therapist, even though I'd been engaged in my own work counseling, after I was fired from, and this is where I begin the book, I was fired from a church in 2003. My pain went underground. I got busy, like many of us do. And I addressed it here or there, but mostly I worked around it for about a decade. And it was almost a decade later when I landed in the hospital. I was in Mexico. We were on vacation, and I had to go to the hospital for really bad stomach pain. Turned out that I needed gallbladder surgery. But even more than that, what they discovered was that my system was septic. And the question that came to me after that was, how did you get to this place at 42 years old? We see men in their 60s or 70s like this, but not in their early 40s. And that's what got me wondering, what has my body kept the score at some level, right? So that prompted the kind of curiosity which leads to some of the stories that I tell in the book.
I think the modeling that you do of your personal story can also be a really healing part of the way, as we move into more stories, that it feels safer for us to see ourselves in your story and other stories, and then begin to share. I was at a meeting with a group of church leaders from mega churches in the U.S., and there was one man who was vulnerable enough to talk about a mental health issue and how it was handled in the church. And he started out by saying all the great ways it was handled in the church. And you just see people around the table kind of like, kind of their body language kind of goes in and, you know, whatever. And then he said, and he started giving the ways the church did not respond in a positive way. And then you see people start, their shoulders go back. They, you know, whatever. And then there were so many stories that came from that context of like having an opportunity to share something because somebody went first. And so, so thanks for leaning in to some of those things and make it easier for the rest of us to name those things, because I think you're right. Your body does hold in those things.
Yeah. Well, vulnerability is the only pathway to healing, right? Like I think one of the things I say in the book is that it's not suffering that causes trauma. It's suffering alone that causes trauma. We all suffer, right? In various ways. But you think about two people who go through maybe a similar circumstance. Maybe there's a hurricane. I used to live in Florida. There were hurricanes that came through. There were wildfires that come through where David is, right? Two people who go through the same suffering. One person isolates, maybe goes off on his own with a case of beer or something like that. Another person finds his way to some community, to family members, and is taken in and heard and seen in the midst of it. That person is less likely to experience the overwhelm of trauma, right? And so, but that also gives us the pathway out. If that's how trauma begins in one sense, the way out is by telling our story, by being seen, by being known, by coming out of hiding, so to speak, right? To say, hey, it's that really hurt. I offer what sounds like really simplistic advice at the very beginning of the book, but it's say, ouch, say it hurts. I think that's what I needed to do at 42 years old as someone who's a therapist, as someone who is guiding people into these kinds of conversations. Mm-hmm. I had to say, you know, I'm hurting in a way that I don't think I've acknowledged, and it's costing me, it's costing my family, it's impacting my vocation and so much more.
Mm-hmm. Chuck, I wanted to add to that too. I think one thing that I've noticed, and this reflects with what you just shared, how if I'm not being emotionally honest, my body will become very honest. And mm-hmm. I think that's what you caught so well in the book is just being, I mean, we can all understand the metaphor and our body's a temple and we get that and we're happy and grateful, but to like study that temple, to understand that temple, I think is just so, so helpful.
Yeah. I think if people are suspicious of that, and I, you know, it's interesting. It's more often than not Christians who become suspicious of these things. Right. But, what I often do in different contexts is invite people to a slow reading of Psalm 38, where David very, very clearly talks about his body pain, his sighs, his groanings, his aches, you know, and I think it's a whole bodied cry before God, thoughts and feelings and body sensations and the impact on relationships and behaviors and the depths of his soul. And I think that that's what it takes, is it takes us coming out of hiding. Jesus says, blessed are those who mourn, right? And that word, even in the Greek, is a word that means we take what's sort of stuck inside and we bring it to the outside before God, before others, in a posture of vulnerability. So again, there's that word vulnerability. I think it's through vulnerability, being seen, being known, being heard, being held in the midst of our pain, that we begin to heal.
Can I ask you, Chuck, you said at the very beginning there that Christians tend to be more suspicious of their bodies. Is that connected to sort of our traditional understanding of how sin is discussed as the flesh? And yeah. I think in more recent times, as I've studied more of the Greek term for that, it seems more connected to ego, or it's a better association would be ego as opposed to flesh, because I think in my earlier, very simplistic ways, I just thought, well, the body was always the problem.
Yeah.
So if I just cut this thing off, I'll be better with God.
Yeah. I love this subtle shift to ego, because I think that that makes more, way more sense than body. Right. I also think that there've been simplistic ways of talking about transformation, be transformed by the renewing of your minds. By the way, that word means so much more than mind, mental capacities, thoughts, right? But I think it's, we simplified the transformation process to just think different things or think better, or get rid of your stinking thinking, as I used to hear in the 1990s, right? And I think we're talking about a whole body, whole brain transformation that we tend to see in our work when we take our bodies seriously. And I think that's what happened with me, is I was attempting to get through it through my own resources. I was a pretty well-resourced, smart young pastor who kept busy and kept distanced from my own pain. But I love the way you said it, David. I think eventually our bodies catch up with us. Eventually our bodies keep the score. They tell the story. And I was a bit puzzled. You know, why am I having this stomach pain? Why am I landing in the hospital at 42 years old, right? But it led to the kind of curiosity that sent me down this trail of healing that I've been on now for the last almost 15 years. It's been really important to pay attention to my body.
Yeah. In one way or another, we all battle with the adversary's lies and undermining our faith and trust in God. And we wrestle with questions like, does somebody have it better than me? Is somebody better at this than me? Do I have enough? Am I enough? What thoughts and advice can you offer that can help us reclaim shalom and connectedness in the face of those lies?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the way I narrate the lies goes back to Genesis chapter 3. I was once upon a time, a long, long time ago, getting ready to do a PhD in biblical studies before a very kind but very honest counseling professor called me out and said that I had a lot of work to do in my own life. And I hit pause on biblical studies training, but I was doing a lot of work around the image of God. And one of the things I say in there is that the image of God, you can go in a number of different directions in terms of what it means, but I boil it down to three things: worth, belonging, and purpose. That God has created us for worth, belonging, and purpose. And the very things the adversary, the serpent in Genesis chapter 3 attack, you know, in his gaslighting in Genesis chapter 3 are our worth, our sense of belonging, and our sense of purpose. Now, you have to sort of read between the lines to get there, but that's what I flesh out. And so each of us really wonders, am I worth it? Do I belong? Am I loved? Do I matter? Right? We wrestle with these kinds of core questions. And I think that those questions show up in a variety of different ways, right? They're reinforced by our parents, by coaches, by teachers, by, you know, tough relationships. I mean, this got really bad for me in middle school, I remember. And it's amazing now at 55 years old, it's some of those same things that I heard back then. You don't belong. We don't want you. You'll never fit in. Reside within me today. I can be sitting around the table with my faculty colleagues and think, you know, they're secretly thinking he's the one who doesn't belong at this table. He should just get out of here. What he has to share with us, you know, the role he plays here really doesn't matter. And so those are some early wounds that keep on whispering within us, right? And so I think here again, I don't know of another way. I don't know. Here's a book that you can read, or here's a, you know, practice that you can implement. I don't know any other way but through relationship, having people in your life who reflect back to you, no, Chuck, I want you around this table. You do belong. You do matter. And then hearing the whisper of that from God, you know, experiencing that kind of relational intimacy with God in a profound way that invites you to begin to remember your deepest worth, your deepest belonging, your deepest sense of calling. I really don't know any shortcuts other than that kind of relational and vulnerable pathway to transformation.
Seems like to me that the work that we individually are not doing in those areas is also what is separating us within the church that creates these huge divides.
Yeah.
Because if we can't find that worth in ourselves, we can't offer it to someone else. And it just creates more and more division in the church, when really what the world needs is more of that authenticity. And when I realize I'm enough, I also can offer that.
Yeah.
You belong. You have worth.
Yeah. I mean, I think if we don't do work around our own shame, we're going to become perfectionists and judgers who divide with others, right? If we don't do work around our own anger, we're going to become violent people, you know, at some level, even in our words, even in our reactions, right? If we don't transform our sadness, do work around our sadness, we'll bring that sadness into all of our relationships in a way that perhaps demands others to meet our needs in ways that, or maybe overfunctions. I think my own untransformed sadness led to overfunctioning, led to me becoming the helper. I'll be there for you in your sadness as a way of not addressing my own, right? So, I mean, I think this is why we do work around our sadness, our shame, our anger, our confusion, our powerlessness, all these things, right? But because I think you're right. I think what the division, the polarization we're seeing in our churches is in part due to the reality that we haven't done this work ourselves.
If I can follow up to that, I think another challenge that I'm picking up here on is also the issue with the Bible, that we have to be very careful being alone with the Bible. Because Chuck, what you did in the very beginning of the book in terms of walking through that story in the garden and how God comes around, for many years, I had all those abuse messages or trauma messages. And so I'm reading that in a very distorted way. And I don't know if it was Augustine that said the most important thing about a person is what they think about when they think about God. But if that image of God is off, then the whole program is kind of is corrupted. But I love how you took it down that path and then replaced it with, but what if God was approaching this way to our brokenness?
Yeah. And you know, there's a subtle reframe in there as I tell that story in a different kind of way, with God is far more, I think, curious and compassionate than many of us knew growing up. You know, what I heard in Genesis chapter 3 was God marching out of the garden. Where are you? What have you done? But I don't expect that subtle reframe will convince people, because that's not how we changed, right? It's gotta go deeper. And we've got to ask ourselves, so how did I internalize this, you know, this message that really goes back to what the serpent was trying to convince Adam and Eve of, that God isn't trustworthy, that God's actually angry, that God doesn't love you, that God doesn't see your inherent worth. I know in the tradition I grew up in, we didn't begin with our inherent worth, our inherent belonging, our inherent sense of purpose or calling or ambassadorship. We began with our inherent wickedness, depravity. And so, of course, God was angry. And of course, that's how we tell the stories, you know. And so there was a lot of undoing and redoing, a lot of deconstruction and reconstruction. I know those are terrifying words for some folks, you know, but really it's in keeping with the tradition. We see this throughout scripture too. You've got to be undone to be redone. You know, you've got to go through the dark night to experience the transformation, 3 days in the belly of the whale to experience the rescue, right? So there are the wilderness to get to the promised land. There are these metaphors for transformation. And that's what that had to happen for me, even to read that story in a new way.
Wow. Well, if I can jump forward to your third question in the book, have you eaten? Ask us to consider, where have you taken your hunger? Not in a way to shame us, but as a call for us to find healing from our places of pain, weariness, and or addiction. The book shares personal stories of healing, moving from a preoccupation with sin or addiction as the problem to dealing with deeper issues below the outward problem. Help us understand your thoughts in that section of the book.
Yeah, well, I've just seen, and again, particularly in the church, I pastored in Orlando and San Francisco and heard this a lot. People caught up in the behavior. I want to change my behavior. I don't like what I'm doing. I want to do something different. And, you know, 9 out of 10 times, I want you to do something different too, if you're caught up in some sort of addictive pattern. Right. But I think, what I'm pointing to there, and I think what that third question is getting at, is it's not the behavior. The deepest problem is the wound that's led to the behavior. So if we can get to the wound, right, if we can get to the context, in one sense, of that behavior, we've got a fighting chance for transformation to happen, right? And so that third question, by the way, was initially a bit puzzling to me. God starts with, where are you? He continues with, who told you? And then he asks the question, have you eaten from the tree I commanded you not to eat from? And I was like, what is God getting at there? But I think what God is getting at is, where have you taken your hunger and thirst? Where have you gone with your deepest longings? You know, how have you attempted to satisfy or soothe yourselves on your own? And I think that when we've experienced wounds in life, we look for ways to soothe. Our addictions are understandable ways of soothing our pain. And so I don't approach addiction, for instance, or behaviors that people find problematic with a hammer, like, stop doing that, right? I approach those addictions with a lot of curiosity. How's that working for you? I wonder why that's become important to you for the sake of a soothing that you've needed, right? That too much drinking in the evening, that pornography use, that overeating, whatever it might be, there's something about that that's working for you. Let's get a bit curious about that. So it really changes the nature of the conversation. And again, it approaches the conversation with a whole lot more compassion. These are compensatory strategies, to use psychological language, that we're engaging to deal with deeper pain. So let's get curious about that deeper pain, those deeper wounds.
Hello, I'm Kevin Witham, and I've been a volunteer with Common Ground Unity since its inception. And I want to take just a brief break here to discuss putting the mission of Common Ground Unity into practice and taking a new step. Unity flows out of our relationship with God. It's from the Spirit, and yet we're called to maintain the unity of the Spirit through humble, loving, gracious connection and relationships with one another. That's why Common Ground Unity was created, and that's why we want to take it to a new level that will bless you, those that participate in this ministry. And that's why we've created the Common Grounds app. It's your digital home to find local members, grab a coffee, or start a gathering right in your neighborhood. Inside, you can join or lead subgroups for local gatherings, Bible study, prayer, parenting, singles, and much more. Plus, you'll have instant access to our resource library full of videos, podcasts, and study materials. Just click the link in the show notes to join the free app. Finally, to do all of this, we urgently need your support. Of course, through your prayers, but also through your tax-deductible donation. That would really help this ministry. You can help us to share the positive message and foster unity literally around the globe. You can give today via our website or the link in our show notes. Thank you for walking this journey with us. Now back to the episode.
I think in some ways, Chuck, you are describing almost a recreating that garden experience for people, where you represent that curious, loving God approaching someone in that circumstance. I know also you quoted Gabor Mate a few times in your book, and I know he's commented said some profound things about addiction that, like you mentioned in the book, it's not a moral failure, but a response to suffering. Wow, that opens up a whole different mindset and curiosity about these things.
Curiosity, right? I mean, it's a different approach. Gerald May wrote on addiction 20, 30 years ago, a wonderful book, Addiction and Grace. In many ways, he said a lot of the same things that Gabor Mate would say many years later. And he became my spiritual director for just a short period of time. And I remember experiencing a kind of compassion. You just named it, David. Like, we can show up with that same compassion that God shows up with in Genesis 3. And I remember experiencing from him, from some of my early mentors and supervisors, like, they didn't come at me with, I can't believe you're doing that, Chuck. I can't believe who you've become. they approached even my own addictions with a whole lot more curiosity than I anticipated. And that's a game changer, because then we shift internally from a place of like, fight, I've got to overcome this, or I've got to defend myself from accusations, to a place of curiosity, to a place of compassion, to a place of rest, where now we can begin to ask, like, well, how did I get here? Why did that soothing work for me in the first place? And why was I attempting to soothe? You know, what happened in my story that left me with such an ache, with such pain?
Yeah. In the last few chapters, you talk about the self-soothing and the dark night of the soul and the holy hunger. And along with that, you talk about having an outward or verbal conversation with yourself about what's going on inside.
Yeah.
And we were just kind of talking about that, like where you can finally like look and see like what drew you into that. And can you expand on the importance of these topics as they relate to coming home to yourself and healing what's within?
Yeah. Well, that metaphor of the dark night, that goes back to the 16th century in a Spanish mystic named St. John of the Cross. And nowadays people use the language of the dark night all the time, or if you've watched Batman, then you know that in a different kind of way. But St. John of the Cross talked about it in a very particular kind of way, about a season that we go through of darkness, of dryness, where it feels like, you know, that doubt is taking over, where it feels like God is a million miles away, that can actually be transformative for us. He talks about it as not as God going away, but as the things that we were using to self-medicate not being quite as powerful as they used to be. You know, so those old addictions that I go to are just not working for me like I remember them working for me. And he says this: there's the possibility of transformation if we allow ourselves to recognize that God is actually drawing us into a deeper desire, into something far more beautiful, far better than our addictions. But my sense is that we've lost the wisdom of the dark night of the soul. We rush to figure out what's going on and to fix it, right? So we find new and different ways of self-medicating rather than asking the deeper question. I wonder what's happening here. I wonder, you know, sort of taking an account of that darkness that we're experiencing, the doubt, and creating space for it and being okay with it. That's what my early first spiritual director taught me, was that it's okay for us to lean in, to create space for this, to not be in a rush, that God's not going to go away, that I shouldn't be terrified of the dark, in a sense. I just wanted him to tell me what to do to fix it, right?
But yeah, the great fixers in America, right? You know, so this is the problem, and now we fix it. So
do it as quickly as possible. And what he was wanting me to do was to sit with it, to honor the inner reality, maybe even to draw it out a little bit, you know? And that at some level was terrifying, but also really enticing, really intriguing. And I think it was through that season that I first experienced a kind of deepening of my own soul. Like there's something here beyond our quick fixes and our fast food remedies that I think is more lasting, more powerful. And I think it's kind of scary though, right? But will God show up in the midst of that dark night? Will others show up in the midst of that dark night? Like I'm really grateful that there were folks who sat with me in the midst of mine. But for some of us, I want to recognize that for some of your listeners, that can be absolutely terrifying. Like they're sitting there thinking like, oh, I have no one to sit with me, or I can't afford a therapist, or I've always been alone. No one wants to sit with me in my pain. So it can be kind of scary.
Can you give, like, maybe there's not one or two things that come to mind, but just the process of being able to be still, to sit with, like, what does that mean in our context, to sit with or to wait on God in that process, to be comfortable in that way? Is there one or two, I hate to say tips, that you can give us, but what are two steps
yeah,
that can help us start moving toward that, because it sounds, the scary part for me, who is a fixer and yeah. is in ministry, and people expect, they have an expectation that if you're aware of a problem with yourself or someone else, that you're going to start moving toward like a goal of something.
Yeah.
So what are one or two, is there a phrase that you could, yeah. that you would say to yourself to help slow you down? Is there a, yeah. any kind of thing that you can help us?
Here's one really simple thing. I get into this a bit in a chapter that's called Say Hello, because I think we've got to address the parts of us that are clamoring for the fix, you know, who are wanting to stay busy. And here's the, as close as I'll ever get to a tip, I guess, it's shh. Like I would put my hand on my chest and, you know, for that busy part that just wanted to kind of get going and avoid the pain, shh. You know, for the part of me that wanted to go back to an old addiction and avoid, shh, right? And it's like, imagine sitting around with your kids and they're kind of loud around the dinner table. But now imagine that those kids are inside of you, you know, and they're quite loud and they're clamoring for a fix. Sometimes it's, shh, it's going to be okay. God will meet us here. It might take a little time. It might be scary. But you're providing some comfort from the perspective of your adult self, or what Thomas Merton called your true self. And I think that's really important.
Well, Chuck, it's interesting. I, last year I got trained in level one for internal family systems, but I'll be honest, reading your book, just brought so much clarity to that whole model. Mm-hmm. And just even the example you just gave, to pause, to say hello. Yeah. I think that's such a wonderful, yeah. wonderful tool. So thank you for that.
So the model that David referred to is internal family systems. It goes back to late 80s, early 1990s, a guy named Richard Schwartz, who talks about our internal divisions. But and I first encountered it in the early 2000s. I found a therapist to do work with and really started working with my own inner division, my own parts. But what I often like to say to people, I've been working with it for so long that it's become really internally familiar to do this kind of work of shh, right? But what I often say to people is this is deep within the Christian tradition. It goes back to scripture. You can see this in St. Augustine, in St. Augustine's Confessions, where he talks about his inner divisions, his inner fragmentation. And so if people are a little spooked by, you know, some psychology modality, right, that's been around for 20 years, like, what do we do with this? Why are they talking about parts and inner divisions and stuff like that? Why is Chuck whispering to different parts of him? There's actually a long tradition of acknowledging and understanding our own inner divisions, the parts of us that maybe are large and in charge and forge forward and busy ourselves, the parts of us that are scared, that feel alone, that feel ashamed, that just need some care and compassion. The parts of us that want to take over and fix it in an instant, all these different parts of us, the reality is that scripture gives voice to these different ways that we engage the world and God, and the church tradition does too. So it's really fascinating, I think, to think of our inner divisions and how God can meet us in the midst of them.
That's right.
I think as you're saying that, Chuck, it reminds me, like, having been part of a church staff and then worked with parachurch and now working ecumenically and whatever, it's so encouraging to hear you talk about like the biblical foundation of this, because it seems like so many times the message we get from church leaders or even in academia or whatever is that to be slow or thoughtful or to take time is a sign of weakness.
Yeah.
And so to be able to shift that narrative and show the strength
yeah.
of shushing yourself and, you yeah. know, like the value of listening being more the value than talking and, yeah. you know, all of those things, I really appreciate yeah. the underpinnings of, yes, this is part of our tradition. This is not like we culturize the scripture. Like in some contexts where I am overseas, I'm listening to people explain why this or this does or doesn't happen in the church.
Yeah.
And so I've listened for a while and I'm saying, okay, can you show me in scripture where that's why that doesn't happen in the church? Or is that your church culture for the last 300 years?
Yeah.
And could you look at it differently? And it's such a, whatever, but I'm thinking we get so used to what is normal or accepted in the culture that we live in.
Yeah.
And that whole thing that you just described of slowing down, of listening, of not having an immediate fix or being large and in charge. Yeah. You know, you look all around and people who are large and in charge, those are the ones that people want to emulate. And other people are ones that just can't get it together.
Yeah.
Which is completely opposite in, in most contexts.
I'd say slowing down is the heart language of the nervous system, in a sense, the human nervous system. I've been doing a lot of work on character formation over the last couple of years and for a new book. And I talk about the inner conditions for character change, because one of the questions that came out of the narcissism work was, how do people change? And I often say, you know, a nervous system stuck in sympathetic, what I call sympathetic storm in the book and Healing What's Within, is a nervous system in go mode, right? Or fight or flight or fawn or find, you know, constantly going. There's an energy that the move to transformation for some people then at that point is like, well, I just need to read another book, or I just need to go on a vacation, or I just need to, and it's anxious energy, right? I think the nervous system's ideal conditions for transformation are conditions of rest. We're slowing down. We're slowing things way down, and we're experiencing reconnection with God, with ourselves, as we talked about at the top of our time together here. And from that place, from a place of reconnection, relationship, rest, we can begin to be transformed. We recognize there, though, that the old strategies that we used, you know, just going to read the book, or just do that program, or just do those three steps, or just do the, we're largely born out of our anxious coping mechanisms, and they exhausted us. And so, you know, hopefully we get to a point where we're like, that didn't work anyway. I don't want to go down that road again. Maybe there's something different, but I get what you're saying, that I think by and large, sometimes, you know, churches will look at that, approach that as weakness. You know, there's got to be something that you can do that will be fast and easy and transformative, you know, and that sometimes that's how they build big churches, is, you know, through those three quick steps to your best life now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And another part of what you're talking about too, I think, is like how we can distract ourselves from that work of slowing down and not feeling what we feel. We in Ukraine and Poland right now are doing trauma care camps for kids from Ukraine that are 11 to 16. And we want to engage the American church to come and volunteer. And one of the hardest parts, like I thought all along, it would be listening to the stories of trauma from these kids. And that part has been a lot easier because those kids are totally authentic. They're just saying like what things are. The harder part is having Americans be able to sit and listen without immediately trying to fix or distract. And so we do these resiliency kind of activities, whatever. And one volunteer said, I think we should stop doing that because it's making them sad. And I was like, I don't think that they're made sad. They are sad. And I was like, but what would you suggest we do? More crafts. And I was just like, okay. So we want to distract their feeling of sadness with something else. And then the more I got irritated, the more I realized it's me. Yeah. Like that is exactly what I do. Like when I don't want to sit in my sadness, when I don't want to be uncomfortable with whatever, I just find some way. It can be a meaningful way, or it can be binging Netflix, you know, whatever it is, but I just want to distract myself. Yeah. And so your book is really super helpful in naming things in a way that we can see differently and give language differently to these values.
Yeah, like there is a way of flourishing beyond those strategies that exhaust us. And I think I love that you're stumbling into it and I'm stumbling into it. You know, I'm pretty thick headed, so it's taken me a long time, it feels like, but it's coming from a lot of like, I've gone down that road and that was a detour. That was a dead end. That wasn't helpful. So slowly but surely finding my way there, but gosh, in fits and starts.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of times relearning a lesson I thought I already learned.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm, yeah. That's right. So that's right. I'm just curious, like when we're talking about this, like the dark night of the soul moment and really the need for community around that. And in some cases that can be the person sitting with you can be a trained therapist or whatever. Right. But have you seen examples where there can be some community that we build around ourselves of peers or non-professionals that can help move us through, maybe using your book as a tool or what would you say to that, to people who need to be in a space like that? How is that best to do?
Yeah. Like I often say to folks who are interested in that, don't overthink it, you know. Sure, you can use healing what's within as a guide, but just find your way to one another in a quiet setting where you're not going to be distracted too much, at least, right? Probably not best in a loud coffee shop or something like that. And whether it's exercises from my book or I think Kurt Thompson has done this really well in his confessional communities, right? Find your way to some I start with Genesis 3, some way of coming out of hiding, some way of answering that question, where are you? Begin with where you are in the moment. I'm tired. I'm distracted. I'm overwhelmed. I'm in over my head. I'm just too busy right now. You know, again, don't overthink it. Just start with where you are right now. And then let that fall to the next obvious step as you continue with curiosity. I do think sometimes that we, one of the problems in the therapeutic community is we so convince people that you need an expert to sit with you. I think when you're stuck in particular traumas, right, that when you're stuck in particular addictions, there are places where I as a therapist can be very helpful to you, but you can begin with a good friend. Find your way to a quiet place and have a honest conversation and begin there.
Chuck, this past year, I got introduced and involved in a gang rehabilitation program here in LA. And one of the founders of that program talked about systems change when people change, and people change when they are cherished. Not when they're fixed, not when they're put back on the right track. But I just want to say, I think your book is absolutely almost like a handbook on how to actually practice that cherishing of our own parts, but also even learning how to cherish others. So thank you so much for your work.
Yeah. Thank you. I love that. I love what you just shared. And I think it's as simple as that. And I think maybe if there's a takeaway for listeners, how can I find my way to a relationship where I'll be seen, I'll be known, I'll be cherished, you know? And again, as I said earlier, that might be tough for someone who's listening right now, who feels particularly alone. Like I'll just say, because I'm a helper, I often find in my own life that is there someone that's going to, unless I pay someone to do it, is there someone that's going to ask me a question? People don't naturally ask me questions because I'm the guy who asks other people questions, right? And so just to sort of express some solidarity with someone who might be listening right now, who might think, I'm just not sure that there's anyone out there who will cherish me. Yeah. Yeah, I get that. I think probably all of us get that at some level on this call, right? And I think there might be some fear there, but we lean into with some courage to, hey, would you have a chance to have some coffee with me? I'd love to get to know you. I'd love to be known by you.
Excellent.
David, I feel like I talked so much. So do you want to ask this last question?
Sure.
That has my name on it?
Okay. I'd love to be Tina for a moment. I've got a internal Tina part. You mentioned that we have become experts at ignoring our bodies and our emotions. Can you talk about how the internet and social media are hindering us in this regard? And can you offer some examples of how media could possibly be beneficial, offering tools and strategies to not ignore our bodies and emotions?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's so easy to demonize all of these things, right? I mean, if you just you go back decades, I mean, we've always found something to demonize. You know, when I was a kid in youth group, it was rock and roll. You know, we threw out all of our records. We brought in our tapes and our records and we burned them. You know, we're always looking for something to demonize. I think like anything, it can be a source of disconnection or connection. There are days when I found my way to the internet and I'm lost in disconnection. I'm just scrolling and I'm not there. And there are relationships that I have encountered through online connection, through whether it's Twitter or Facebook. I've then actually met the person face to face. And there's a celebration of the reality that we met in this weird digital space and we somehow found our way to one another and forged a friendship through it, right? And so there, I think like anything, it can divide in two different directions. The litmus test for me is this drawing me to connection right now or to disconnection? And so whether that's when I was growing up, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, or, you know, overeating or drinking or exercise. Yeah, I was talking to a client about this who thought exercise was probably just one of these neutral things. And I was like, no, exercise is used by a lot of people to as a bypass of what's really going on, as a way of disconnection. And for others, as a way of connection to their bodies, to their nervous systems, to their breath, just good physical action, right? So yeah, I think each and every one of these things could go in either direction.
Excellent. Thank you.
Well, we have so many like good thoughts represented in this conversation. And I want to encourage our listeners. There was a couple times where Chuck said something about being courageous and David talked about being curious. And we live in a society that is polarized and that can have built-in divisions. And so Common Grounds Unity, you know, our goal is to support the gathering of like-minded people. And I'm going to just throw out one idea, and that is our Facebook group. If right now you want to move towards someone for conversations, discussions, maybe ask if someone read this book that they would like to like have a conversation. It doesn't have to be over 6 weeks and you don't have to even be in the same city with technology, but go to our Facebook group and throw out a question that you're curious about and see if you can't make some kind of connection, or within your church, if you don't feel like that being inwardly focused or doing this kind of work is valued, be courageous and ask someone if they're interested in this kind of conversation and use Chuck's book as a way to start a conversation. We're not going to move closer together without that curiosity and without courage and willingness to do things differently than we've done before. And so I really appreciate the time with you, Chuck and David, and I really appreciate the work of Common Grounds Unity. And if you benefit from this ministry, just like every other kind of ministry, there are expenses that go into this, consider financially supporting the work or make a commitment to pray for this work. You know, the discernment and wisdom that goes into our podcasts and choosing leaders in different cities to host these times of gathering around coffee and, you know, be part of our community in some way. And if you've got suggestions for people that you would like us to talk with, put that in our Facebook message, email John at commongroundsunity.com. And yeah, let's make our community closer. Let's be unified in the work of God's church, especially in a time when the world is pretty broken and needs the hope and the good news of the gospel that we are privileged to have access to. So thanks so much, guys, for your time today. Thanks, John Teal, our producer. And we really look forward to our next time together. Thanks, you all.
Thank you for listening to the Common Grounds Unity podcast. Please check out commongroundsunity.org to learn about who we are and find gatherings in your area. Please don't forget to download the CGU app. You can also subscribe to our monthly digital newsletter, join the Facebook group, or find our YouTube channel. Until next time, God bless, and remember, unity starts with a cup of coffee.